Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Tuesday the 25th of June, the year 2013. Today on Juneau afternoon we'll be listening to a speech by Alice Rogoff entitled On the Arctic, recorded before the Juneau World Affairs Council last Wednesday, April the 10th. Weather forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers, a slight chance of thunderstorms in the evening with low temperatures around 55 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, coolers with showers likely. Thursday, showers likely with high temperatures around 62 degrees. Thursday night, cloudy skies with scattered showers, and Friday through Saturday night looks like mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 67 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in the case of adoptive couple versus baby girl, according to the Associated Press. In today's 5-4 decision, the justices say a Native American child does not have to be taken away from her adoptive parents and given to her biological father. Dustin Brown, the father, is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. The court examined whether Brown or the South Carolina couple the girl's mother chose for a planned adoption would be her home. The father claims he was not properly informed about the adoption. Brown expressed his feelings in a video released before the high court began oral arguments.
I just want the same right that every other American has, the right to raise my own child. I hope for a bright future for her, the best.
For more than 2 years, the child was with Matt and Melanie Capobianco before South Carolina courts ruled in favor of the father. The case involves the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act intended to keep Native families together. Tribes, advocates, and Native organizations are concerned about potential impacts the case may have on Indian country. An indigenous leader in Argentina met with Catholic Pope Francis Monday to discuss issues facing the country's indigenous communities. Some of those issues are land rights and access to education, healthcare, and adequate housing. The meeting reportedly ended with a promise by the Pope to speak with the country's president. More from Eilish O'Neill.
Felix Diaz of the Comb people of northern Argentina is one of the elected spokespeople of Argentina's 20 indigenous nations. He hopes to meet with Argentine President Cristina Kirchner to discuss the problems faced by the country's indigenous people.
We would ask her to begin to enforce our constitutional rights as we deserve, and we would tell her that our rights cannot be negotiated. We don't believe she can tell us that we don't have rights because we are the first peoples. We existed before the Argentine state.
The president has not yet responded to a meeting request made by Argentina's indigenous people in early June. Pope Francis said he would ask the president to meet with indigenous leaders, Diaz reported to the press after meeting with the Pope Monday morning. According to Diaz, the Pope said that dialogue is the best path. For National Native News, I'm Eilish O'Neill in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Motorcycle enthusiasts will gather in Minnesota the first weekend in July to take a more than 100-mile journey from the Red Lake Reservation. The bike rally is to draw attention to suicide prevention. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suicide is the second leading cause of death for American Indians and Alaska Natives ages 10 to 34. Organizer of the bike rally, Bill May, is one of many people who have dealt with the issue.
You know, I've been through this, you know, in my own personal life, and I think about my grandson every day that committed suicide, and I don't know why it happened. I can't know. There's no answers to any of that, you know, but it's just that what it boils down to is somebody cares.
Funds raised by the rally will go directly to families dealing with suicide. The bike rally is planned for July 6th. The Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs is updating tribal leaders on a number of Interior Department activities at a gathering in Reno, Nevada today. Kevin Washburn will address issues like a land buyback program and propose changes to Bureau of Indian Affairs land into trust regulations. Tribal leaders across the country are attending the National Congress of American Indians mid-year conference to focus on top issues. During this week, in 2010, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Healing Foundation launched a three-day event in Queensland, Australia. Topics included traditional medicine, intergenerational trauma, and healing. The event followed the 2008 government apology to Aboriginal children removed from their homes known as the Stolen Generations. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2014, with applications accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This Juneau World Affairs Council presentation is a co-production with 360 North and was recorded on April 10, 2013 at Studio 360 in Juneau. The World Affairs Council's Jim Clark introduced Alice Rogoff, who spoke on the Arctic.
Good evening. I'm Jim Clark with the Juneau World Affairs Council. We're a nonprofit group that provides these various get-togethers for free. We've had some very, very interesting speakers this spring. I'd like to thank our sponsors for helping us with the with these various programs: Alaska Electric Light and Power, GCI, Greens Creek, Kensington, Wassman and Associates, and Sea Alaska have all contributed mightily to making this program work. Tonight we have Alice Rogoff, who is the publisher of the Alaska Dispatch. And it's pretty hard to describe all the things that Alice does. She's a very much a newspaper person. She spent 12 years with Mort Zuckerman at U.S. News and World Report. She was a business manager and assistant to Donald Graham at the Washington Post. She co-founded Alaska Native Arts and Alaska House in New York, where with the idea of selling Alaska Native art and bringing it to the East Coast. For the previous 2 years, 2012-2011, she's run a forum entitled The Arctic Imperative, and she's shown tremendous interest in the Arctic, and I think you're going to find her talk tonight extremely interesting and provocative. And since you want to hear from her and not from me, let me introduce Alice Rogoff.
Thank you kindly. Thank you all for being here. There's a new Arctic strategy document that's just been released from the federal government. I don't know if any of you here have seen it. I haven't read every word of it, but I've skimmed it, and I will tell you it's very thoughtful, very well written, very detailed, and in the end doesn't say much. I'm allowed to say that as a private citizen, and it probably won't surprise any of you. The federal government's view these days is talking is important and good, and cooperation is essential, and what we really need more of is research and good science, and I can't disagree with one word of that. But what I'm going to talk about today, after I show you a short film clip, is why I think that the time for talking is long past and now we have to start doing. So I'm showing you this film clip because I just came across it, and to me it is the most compelling 9 minutes you could spend to understand why this subject has gone from timely to urgent.
The Arctic, as we know it, as I knew it back in 77, is a totally different place. It's been basically about a 10% loss of ice per decade for the last couple decades, but it really didn't hit home to us because of the variability, interannual variability, until 2007. And 2007 was the year that the ice just completely disappeared. That summer, we were working in the east of Beaufort. We were out at Katobic. We were in the east of Beaufort. And there was a tremendously different summer. I've never seen anything quite like it. No ice anywhere. A lot of things that were seen in abundance that we normally don't see. Huge, enormous copepod populations, for instance. A lot of jellyfish that we don't see. I mean, the ocean was just packed with jellyfish. And jellyfish are kind of a dead-end trophic step. I mean, in the Gulf of Mexico, turtles eat jellyfish. But, you know, jellyfish are not really consumed by a lot of higher trophic level organisms. I mean, I don't see polar bears running around or walrus eating jellyfish. And so that was unusual. And there was lots of them. I mean, they were dense. And that was the summer we saw tremendous erosion of the Garda coastline. So it hit home in 2007 that, wow, we are really dealing with a different system now. You know, I mean, the Arctic assumed its permanent ice cover sometime over the last, general consensus is last million, 1.5 or so million years, somewhere in that area. Of course, there's been a lot of interglacial, glacial cycles over that period where the ice has waned and come back. But that's happened over tens of thousands of years. This cycle here, in which we've lost ice over a period of no more than a couple decades, is unprecedented. So it's the rate of change that makes us a little bit nervous, a little apprehensive about what's in store for the Arctic food web and for a lot of the highest trophic level creatures we see there. Inupiats are accustomed to going out in their boats and fishing. They do it all summer long, and their boats are not designed for big waves, and because they don't normally see big waves. And a family went out and went fishing, and we're gone for a while. And I remember being on the beach at Katowic with a local native who was butchering a bearded seal they had just killed. And I was talking to him about the bearded seal. I wanted to see the stomach contents, what have you. And all of a sudden, his cell phone rang. And he talked for a few minutes in Inupiaq. I didn't understand what he was saying. And then he just left. He left the ulu there. He left the bearded seal there. Didn't say a word and just took off. And I was left standing there going, what's going on? I mean, I didn't understand. It was a few hours later when we saw the whole town, things moving very quickly in the town, boats being mobilized and pushed into the water and people running everywhere, that we found out that at the moment he had received that phone call, a boat had come back with only part of the family had left a week earlier or several days earlier, and that was the mom and one of the boys. And she had quite a story to tell, in which they had been on a barrier island, they had been in a spit, they had been camping out, the boat was anchored, and the wind came up. And they were just getting ready to have dinner and just finished fishing for the day. And the wind came up, and the seas came up, and all of a sudden, the island that they never normally see inundated with water in the summertime, all of a sudden, it was awash with water, and the boat, which had been anchored nearby, all of a sudden broke its anchor and started drifting away. And so the father started running after the boat through the water and his 15-year-old son following him. And the boat got into deeper and deeper water as the wind and waves pushed it off the shoal, and they both were swimming for it. And in the process of swimming for it, they both drowned. That was a very poignant example of how things have changed. They weren't accustomed to situations like that. They weren't accustomed to waves of that size ever, you know, and having to deal with the change, the Arctic, the new Arctic. The new Arctic is not a place for small boats and to be camped out on a low elevational barrier island anymore. It could be washed over easily in the summers now, where in the past that never would happen. And that's what I mean about adaptation. Humans have to adapt as well as the animals. Predictions for an ice-free Arctic have ranged from 20, in the literature have ranged from recent literature, 2050 to 2100, and with some papers saying 2025, year 2025. But there are other colleagues who are convinced, and I believe them, that we're going to see an ice-free Arctic probably by 2020. It could happen in the next 5 years. Because of the positive feedbacks between loss of ice, absorption of long wave radiation by a black surface. So once you melt the ice, once you lose ice and lose that albedo, which is reflecting long wave radiation back into the atmosphere, now you have a dark surface that's absorbing heat. It's just like on a hot day in Texas, you're walking down the street in bare feet, you're going to walk on the white line, which is reflecting heat back. And the pavement, the black pavement, is very, very hot. And that's because it's a dark surface absorbing heat. The same parallel in the Arctic with a black ocean, an optically black ocean, and an optically white reflective ice surface. Same deal. And so when you melt a little bit of ice, you are adding that much more heat to the ocean. And so the positive feedback loop is accelerating ice loss. As a consequence, we're seeing the models, projections just didn't seem to have not captured this very rapid positive feedback, and so we're seeing things changing a lot faster than we thought. I try not to get too depressed about it. You can think about it as depressing, but at the same time, there's a lot of opportunities there to understand these systems. Sure, you see some unfortunate things. You see walrus, the baby walrus drowning because they have no ice. Their moms are gone, and that's sad. You hear accounts about polar bears that swim enormous numbers of miles and eventually drown, but if they do reach the coast, they're so emaciated they can't survive. Those are sad stories, but we're an optimistic society, and scientists also tend to want to look at the bright side just like anybody else, and we're hoping to see adaptations to this changing system so the organisms and humans can adapt.
Obviously, I don't think there's anything earth-shattering news there. Certainly not to those of you who are interested enough in the subject to be here today. But to most lower 48 Americans, that would be not only newsworthy, but impossible to believe. People who live on the east coast of the U.S. on barrier beaches are not prepared for the notion that there's going to be an ice-free Arctic in 2020 or 2025, because think what that means about rising sea levels. They haven't factored that into their life's plan yet. Okay, let me back up for a minute just so you know why I'm on this subject. I have been in Alaska roughly for a dozen years, originally commuting, and now I live here and commute back because this is where I want to live. So I'm as passionate Alaska resident as those of you who've been here for generations. I view this whole Arctic subject as I view most things, which is through a prism of realism. I tend to accept pictures and then figure out what to do about them rather than try to deny that the reality is there. When I have looked at this picture, as I have since the year I first became aware of it, which is basically in the year 2008, when a brilliant fellow wrote something called Arctic Meltdown in Foreign Affairs and opened my eyes, I have viewed the subject, as all people do, with fear and apprehension, but also to try and find the silver lining. And to me, there is a tremendous silver lining here, but it's one that is only something to be taken advantage of if we face up to it, and that is the shipping channel that will be going through the Arctic Ocean. So that's why I begin with this first image. This is a view in which the North Pole is smack dab in the middle. And this is not a view you normally see, because what it shows, as I will come back to in the next slide, is that there is now a straight line shipping route from the Bering Strait to the northern coast of Iceland. And already today, even though you're not hearing it, nobody's hearing it publicly, the Chinese, who are long-term thinkers, are planning to have their cargo moving along what they call that center route, straight from China through the Bering Strait and over the top to Iceland and on to wherever else it needs to go on the Atlantic side. Now, here we go. Next image. What does that mean for Alaska? Well, if I look at that picture, I think, holy moly, that means the Panama Canal runs along the western coast of Alaska. And very soon. Because whether or not there is an expanded Dutch harbor, and whether or not there are any other ports in the Arctic today between Dutch harbor, the North Pole, and Iceland, that is the gate to the Arctic. The Coast Guard calls it the Bering Gate. I've heard Admiral Ospo use that phrase. That says it all. And that's why the ships are already going through in exponentially greater numbers every year. And if you talk to the residents of Little Diomede and St. Lawrence Island in Wales, which I am lucky enough to be able to do because I do fly my 206 and get out to the west, they see those boats now. They see the wrecks of the boats now. They're getting the pollution from the boats now. All of this is happening even though we can't see it and no ABC network television crews are out there filming it. But you better believe it's real. So if it's real, what does that mean? Well, this is where I have a tendency to need to go big in order to get to concrete next steps. I think we all do that in some way. You know, the old expression, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. Well, I think, well, where do we want to get? We want to get to economic development for Alaska, at the very least to compensate for what will be lost. What will be lost are clean beaches. We can assume that. But what will also be lost is the subsistence lifestyle of folks who live along the Bering Sea. Okay. So bear with me for a minute, and I am going to use this talk to you today as an excuse to give you my snapshot of what 2050 could look like. Now, it could be any other year. I've picked that one because it's a round number. Okay, so here I go to my first image. What is my point here? That there is one obvious place that everybody knows is the one obvious place for there to be an Arctic port in Western Alaska. It is Nome, and I've added the word Port Clarence in there because that's where the water is actually deep. But Port Clarence is just a few miles from the village of Teller. Teller is connected to Nome by an already existing state-maintained road called the Bob Blodgett Highway, for those of you who know it. I've driven it. The Coast Guard still owns the land at Port Clarence. They used to have an enormously tall Loran Tower, which some of you might have known about. They dynamited it a few years ago, but it's still their land. And Nome has been gradually expanding for its own reasons into a quite vibrant small boat harbor. I think they're out now almost to 30 feet of water depth. Without too much more money, they can dredge to 45 feet, they say. And once they do, they have the ability to fuel and service Coast Guard and military and commercial vessels of just about anyone that would like to make it through the Bering Strait. That is something they are getting ready to seek bonding authority for with the state of Alaska. I don't know whether it will be in the year 2013, 14, or 15, but they're getting their ducks in a row. Why do I put this up here now? Because I happen to believe, as a private citizen, that the best thing the state of Alaska could do to make this a reality is simply declare it a reality. And then the Defense Department and the Coast Guard would say, of course. But at the moment, we're in this ridiculous dance where the state of Alaska won't designate its location for a port, and the federal government says it has no money to spend on a port, so why should it bother to designate one? And the result is we have Kotzebue and Barrow and Dutch Harbor and lots of other smaller villages spinning their wheels, seeking bonding authority, and nobody is organizing around the one and only organizing principle, which clearly makes sense for the entire state. And I'm just going out on a limb and saying that as an observer. Okay. So that's where I start my view of the 2050 picture of Alaska. Okay. Now, here I've added Little Diomede. Why? It's a completely non-functional village today. I was just out there. They have every kind of social problem imaginable. They ask for help and get no help. It's one of the saddest things I have ever seen. Again, fortunately, Admiral Ostebo has responded. He's taking a cutter out there in June. But it sits in the middle of the Bering Strait. So if we're the United States thinking strategically about our marine and security interests vis-a-vis Russia, how can we not afford to invest something on that granite rock of Little Diomede? Well, it turns out, when I was there just a month ago, the young fellow who was pointing out things on the Big Diomede skyline, which is just 2 miles across the ice, you know, said, oh, see those things on the tops of the hills there and there and there? Those are new observation posts. Ah, said I, interesting. Saw Admiral Ostebo about a week later, and I said, there are new observation posts on Big Diomede. Oh, he said. Well, apparently that got back to folks in Washington, D.C., and they said, what are you talking about? Well, that scares me as an American, okay? I believe that if we don't get the defense establishment through the excellent leadership of the Coast Guard in Alaska to start believing this picture and quickly, what we're going to have is more stuff on Big Diomede and more stuff in the water just on the Russian side of the dateline, all of which we're going to feel the effects of and none of which will benefit us. And it's already happening. Ask the Coast Guard what they see when they're out there. They see fishing boats lined up all along the dateline. Do you think they're respecting whose fish they're catching or what they're discharging into the water? I don't. Now, I don't mean to be critical of our Russian neighbors. I'm sure they're wonderful people, but I suspect that they, like Americans, have a breakdown in communications at all government levels, and that nobody's really managing this as a coordinated view the way the International Maritime Organization would if we were a party to the law of the sea and the IMO were empowered to start enforcing basic marine safety laws in the Bering Sea. Okay, so that's why I called attention to Diomede. Now, let's go south. There's the Port of Wales. Excuse me, we've gone north first. I put Wales there because it is the eastern edge of the Bering Strait. It's the jumping-off point for Diomede. When Diomede is socked in with weather, everybody stays in Wales. Clearly, there is a need to have some sort of a physical facility with responsible people for marine purposes on duty in Wales. Okay, then you go down. Excuse me, we're going north again for a minute. I'm looking at this from a distance. Why do I go up to Kotzebue and Cape Blossom? Because it's also clear that for the state of Alaska to take advantage of this marine channel, one of the things it needs to do is begin to have its own access to marine shipping. Red Dog Mine sits just to the north and west of Cape Blossom and Kotzebue. Those are now 6 month a year tug and barge operations. Well, they'll probably be 9 months a year pretty soon. The same would be true of whatever is to come in the Ambler Mining District, which is just a few hundred miles to the east of where you see the word Kotzebue. Anything that's mined at that part of the state could be transported on the Kobuk River down to a port at Cape Blossom, and there's a whole new source of income and transit economies for the state of Alaska. Important that that be done, but important that it not be confused with the deep water Arctic port notion for Nome and Port Clarence. And I think even the folks from Kotzebue today would agree with that statement. Okay, now we go down. You'll see Providencia is there just as a point of reference, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Gamble on St. Lawrence Island sits 37 miles from the shoreline of Siberia, specifically the town of Providencia. I have heard various things about how deep that water is. One man told me he remembered walking across it as a child with his grandfather, and the water was only chest deep. Well, that's pretty shallow water. I know that those folks want that to be a no-go zone for any deep water ships, and I know that the Coast Guard didn't hear that message clearly and probably now is, but it will take Russian and IMO cooperation to make sure there are no ships in there, because the ships that go there will run aground. When they run aground, bad things happen. There is absolutely no capacity in the village of Gamble to help with anything when bad things happen. There's no dock. There's no harbor. There are no apprentices to the marine pilots who are even authorized to go out and help in a search and rescue mission. There's no training for any of those people if they wanted to make it a career. So obviously, that's an important place to invest a little bit. Same with Savunga, which is on the very northern shore of St. Lawrence Island. All the same things would be relevant in Savunga, because if the ships stay off the western shore of St. Lawrence Island, they'll be coming along the eastern shore. That means Savunga is the closest place where you're going to need more search and rescue facilities. Okay, then you get down to this. You've got Mykolaiv and the Pribilof Islands, two more places that are way distant from St. Lawrence Island, but still along that shipping channel. Put a little bit of a seasonal dock and a port capability and a search and rescue capability in there, and all of a sudden you have tiny little growing economies in a whole lot of places in the Bering Sea where they didn't exist today, and it enables us to play at least a credible game of defense against what will be a Panama Canal-like circus of marine activity. Okay, now, then you've got Barrow up at the top. Far from least important, Barrow will probably be the most important port in this picture for resource extraction from the north, whatever that will be, whether it's offshore oil or offshore gas or close-in gas or mining across the top. Without making any presumptions, there will be a port at Point Barrow. There has to be. But again, let's not mistake it for the transit port that we need for the Bering Sea traffic. Why? Because it's not at the Bering Strait. So it's considerably to the east of that center route that goes across the North Pole. Okay, so that's where my dream of 2050 ends. You've got a picture now. If you were looking down from Mars in 2050, the western coast of Alaska would be all lit up, right? There would be some form of commercial activity all the way from Barrow to Dutch Harbor. People might have incomes. Some villages would be gone, but others would be healthy. Okay, come back to today. What do we know about how difficult it is to get to this picture? Well, first of all, 2050 might be too far down the road. We might need this by 2030. We're talking 20 years. How long does it take to build a port? How long would it take to build a road and a rail line that would link that port complex in Nome to Fairbanks, to the road system, with a chute up north to the Ambler Mining District, to make it all work as infrastructure for a new and vibrant economy? My guess is that if you did all this, whenever this year came and all this infrastructure were in place, oil would have a much less significant role in the state's fiscal structure and in the state's welfare, and lo and behold, we would no longer be an oil dependency. Now, I hate to use that phrase, but I think it's accurate, and I think the debate in the state legislature this year has given us all a stronger feeling of that than we might have had before. We also have to find ways to make sure that the people who live along that coast are well represented in this whole process of development. We did away with the Coastal Zone Management Program last year. I don't know what will take its place, but to me, in a democracy, it's hard to imagine that the state is going to make decisions for every one of these local communities. You all know that in the lower 48, there's not a town in any state that would let the state tell them what was going to happen in their town, right? Somehow or other, we've fallen into this very different kind of relationships between municipalities and the state here. I don't think it'll last. Okay, so come back to what we have in the state today to work with to make this a reality. Now, here I'm going to switch gears, show you all of that development that is already starting to take place in Russia, just so we don't forget it's not just us here. It's us against a place that's already pouring in billions of dollars to its Arctic coastline. And by the way, in case you're wondering, you can do this yourself. Go to Google Earth and just look at the Port of Pravidania from time to time. They've got some mighty big ships already tied up there. We have nothing from Dutch Harbor all the way to the north. Zero, nada, nothing. It's a preposterous picture. Okay, now I'm going to crib from my beloved friend Scott Minard, the chief investment officer of Guggenheim Partners, who came to Alaska last year and is a great advocate for the economic opportunities in the Arctic. But when he came to Alaska, he wanted to make clear to the state and to policymakers that, yes, there's a tremendous opportunity here, but no, we haven't quite lined our ducks up in a row well to take advantage of it. So let's start with here. This is the picture we all know, the importance of the oil industry. This is why I call us an oil dependency. It's a big, big, big share. Okay, next image. Gross state product breakdown. That's how splintered it is. If it's not oil extraction, everything else is fairly small, therefore has no leverage to move policy. Okay, now we go on to the demographics. All of a sudden, one of the things we all take for granted starts to look like a stunningly important variable, and that is the youth of the population. All those people having all those babies, what they're doing is making this a state unlike most states and certainly unlike Russia, which has nothing but demographics on its side going forward, right? Because you all want to have a young population to support the old people and do all the work that has to be done. And those numbers are really compelling. Okay, but there's the problem. We're not educating them. I found his use of these bar charts to be the single most understandable and depressing thing I'd ever seen. This was pulled together by him a year ago. I'm sure nothing has changed significantly in the year intervening unless it's gotten worse. Okay, and what are we hearing in the legislature right now? Cuts to education. whether or not it's to pay for tax cuts for oil companies. Everyone is under the impression that it's time to cut spending in education. Well, I would argue that between the education bar charts and these very sad bar charts showing the amount that goes into R&D in this state, we are probably looking kind of like Angola. Think about the resource extraction economies of the world where tons of money has come out and very little has been put back in. What is left when the resources are extracted? Usually barren land with no people and no industry and no economy. So, is this a depressing picture or an optimistic picture? Well, the fact is it's both. But it takes people facing up to the facts and deciding to do something about it. Okay, what would I suggest you do about it? I'm going to be very brief, and then we're going to hear your ideas. The first thing I keep thinking is, back on the East Coast, where there's a scarce resource, somebody makes you contribute to the problem of the scarce resource. Namely, if you buy a house in a town where there's not enough parkland, the town will charge you a fee that goes into a land bank so they can buy up land and make more parkland. Sounds reasonable. You pay the fee and you're happy to have the parkland. Well, why is it that Alaska can't have requirements for any entity that gets a claim to extract natural resources that somehow or other they have to invest in developing a leave-behind economy when the resources are gone, whether it's spending it on R&D or spending it on value-added manufacturing or building graduate schools in the state or putting graduate school scholarships into the mix. We don't give graduate school scholarships. They stop at undergraduate. Technical training, ongoing training, adult re-education. There's nothing new in this mix except that it's not in Alaska. I think it's time to start beating the drum. Here's one idea I have for you, and I'll show you this in a minute. I've just been in Iceland and came across a thriving industry in Iceland, Scandinavia, and somewhere, I'm told, in California. Fish skin leather. How much salmon skin do we throw out in this state every year? Let's assume there's a virtually zero cost to working the skins. The skins sell for $75 wholesale when they leave the tanning place. That's unbelievable. That's a value-added industry that we could be trying in every town where the fish come in. I don't pretend to have answers. I just think it's a state of mind that we've got to start spreading around, that rather than focusing on oil taxes, we've got to get our nose out of the present and look at the future, which is already out there in the Arctic Ocean. Okay, that's the end of me giving my personal observations on Alaska's Arctic future. Now, you all tell me what you have to say, think, and ask about this, okay? And thank you for listening to me.
Ben, I just would ask that people that have questions, please come up to the mic and start a dialogue with Alice.
And I might add, I also would love to put out a challenge to anyone to write this in the dispatch. I'm thinking that since I happen to be the publisher of it, and we do not editorialize, I'm sure you know if you read us, I might write some version of this as a commentary just in my own name, and I'd love to challenge others in the state to do the same thing. Please, someone.
It seems to me that it would be very beneficial to have the law of the sea ratified by the United States. What do you think the chances are of that?
Well, I don't pretend to be an expert on this present Congress, but my guess is it's doable sooner rather than later. I have the beginnings of a sense that the most recent era of shall we just call it, Tea Partyism in Washington is on the wane for a whole lot of reasons. And that may mean that reasonableness is allowed to creep back into some conversations. And with John Kerry at State Department and there still being a Democratic majority in the Senate, I think this next year and a half is the one and only good shot they have at it. And I'm guessing that John Kerry is planning for that already. I'll find out. We're supposed to see him in D.C. next week if we're not dealing with North Korea in D.C. next week.
Would you describe a little bit more the function of the nonprofit that you'll be announcing in Washington next week? What are some of the objectives that it would do? What are some of its...
I could go on at boring long length about that, but I find myself saying that ultimately what it will do best is try to distill the conversation into subjects that can be dealt with by the brand new government called the Arctic Council. It's to me a situation that's becoming almost dire for the Arctic Council members. Every industrialized nation in the world wants to have permanent observer status at the Arctic Council. Why? Because they all realize this picture, that this is the new shipping route and that everything that's in the Arctic will be valuable to all of planet Earth. But the Arctic Council is so new and so junior, relatively speaking, that it doesn't have the confidence, the ancillary organizations, the permanent staff, and so forth, to be able to handle anything more than the specific governmental issues that come before it. So I think that if we do a good enough job, and this will take decades to do, of course, but if we do a good enough job of organizing dialogue, then there will be a private sector addendum to every Arctic Council conversation, and it will begin to have its own offshoots, which will develop into more and better governance at the Arctic Council. But what we have now, as I said before, is such a fractured set of conversations going on in academia, in science, in investment banks, in the shipping industry, and then country by country in the Chinese shipping industry versus the South Korean shipping industry versus the Finns and the Russians shipping, that pulling it all together in a way that could make something rational come out of it in terms of infrastructure planning and investment is very difficult. Now, again, we in Alaska have a chance to determine infrastructure in Alaska, but we will not have any chances to decide what would be a relationship between, say, a twinned ice-enabled port in Dutch Harbor or one in Iceland versus Norway. And yet that is a conversation that's already taking place. There's a Norwegian shipping company that thinks they have the perfect location for it in northern Norway. Well, Iceland is hoping to do the same thing. So we just know from experience, all of us as people, that if you don't get together and talk, nothing good happens. That's the concept in the end.
Could you mention the Canadian interaction with this? Because a lot of the passage will be through Canada as well.
Yes, and of course, I don't mean to make Canada in any way less important to this than Russia, but I do think that for the short term, we are now seeing almost a complete reversal of what people thought 10 years ago about where the shipping will be. 10 years ago, we all talked about the Northwest Passage opening up. And I now see that at least those in the know and in the driver's seat in China and Korea are not at all interested in the Northwest Passage and not even interested in the Northern Sea Route over Russia. And that's because I suspect, although nobody's, I think, confirmed this yet, as the ice melts at the pole, it seems to me that it breaks up and travels south. And what that means is that there is something of a donut hole effect happening at the pole, which explains the interest in that center route. It is shorter, but it's also probably more efficient in terms of ice breaking than over Canada and over Russia. Now, Canada, of course, is eyeing its own Arctic coastline very wisely as a place with huge economic opportunity, huge military security requirements, and I think properly so, great economic development opportunities for its coastal residents. I can't ever find fault with what I read of the way they're approaching this subject, but I don't think it has a huge effect on us. Is that an answer? Okay.
We've been hearing a lot more recently about interest in militarization of the Arctic by the U.S., by Canada, by Russia, and potentially others. I wonder, is there any countervailing movement toward demilitarization, such as, for instance, has happened with Antarctica?
It's such a good question, and I wish I could tell you that there is an answer to that. There isn't. What there is a lot of discussion about it. I know that General Ralston, who you all know from Alaska, is probably one of the great thinkers on that very subject. He's back in D.C. all next week with very high-level meetings going on exactly that subject. I think that militarization by the U.S. in the Arctic is not ever going to be a priority unless it's defensive. And my guess is that Russia is going to determine whether it's defensive for us or not. And so far, at least, many of the Russian leaders involved in the Arctic are saying just the opposite, that they want this to be a zone of cooperation. All the Scandinavians say they want it to be a zone of cooperation. In fact, I think that's the overwhelming tone at the Arctic Council, is that we are all in this together and it can't be about a place of military conflict. What I think is going to happen instead, though, is it's going to be a place of economic conflict. And I start with not just the subject of ports and infrastructure, but fisheries. We haven't even gotten to that subject yet. And you all can imagine, knowing what you know about protein sources in the oceans south of the Arctic, that the amount of protein in the Arctic Ocean is probably more than any of us can foresee. And in a world that is quickly becoming protein-starved as climate changes, those are going to be mighty scarce resources. And even with the best case under law of the sea, without something Magnuson-Stevens-like, it's hard for me to see how the law of the sea is going to carve up fishing rights. Now, right now, there's a fishing moratorium, but that's due to be reexamined in what? 2-3 years, a very short time. This one is going to be probably the mother of all negotiations, as they would say. We're past the chance to have made it Antarctica. We have too many people, too many countries, too many regimes having staked their futures on the economic value in the Arctic. I'm just afraid that that extends to the food chain, too. Anyone else?
There's no one else. I'm going to ask another question.
Okay.
In Greenland, which you showed on the map as part of that straight line,
yeah,
they just held an election, and I believe it was in the form of a referendum or initiative to allow the Chinese to either come in and with Chinese workers and develop an iron ore operation in Greenland. What's the status of that?
Well, I wish I knew more. I try to learn what I can, but to my knowledge, there's only one English language publication in Greenland. It's called Greenland Today, for those of you who are interested. I'm going to be seeing Kupik Kleist, who's the outgoing Prime Minister in D.C. next week, and I hope to find more sources. And by the way, the Arctic section of Alaska Dispatch is going to be growing with everything we can find to put in it. It'll be also called Arctic Newswire. But the answer is that I don't think there's any party in Greenland that is not in favor of development. I think it's a question of whether the development happens with or without different processes by the local people. And since virtually all of them are indigenous, it's not about indigenous people versus the Danes. It's within the indigenous community. But as far as I can see, Greenland is open for business and wants the world to know that. The reason is that under their home rule agreement with Denmark, they can't get the final bit of freedom from Denmark until they decide they are financially self-sufficient. And that is a card they hold. It is their choice to decide when they wave and say, we're self-sufficient now, Denmark, goodbye, we're now independent. And they can't do that until they have enough takers for their natural resource extraction business. But I wish I knew more than that and more of the nuances, and I'm going to. I hope to go there this summer. I've been looking at flight schedules, and it's very difficult to get there. Not surprising, if you go onto any of the commercial travel sites, there is no Greenland. You have to go to Air Greenland to find how to get to Greenland, for those of you who are interested.
If we have no more questions, Alice, we'd like to thank you very much for coming and really enjoyed your very provocative talk, and hope that you have the best of luck in announcing the Arctic Circle next week in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Thank you very kindly.
Alice Rogoff spoke on the Arctic at this Juneau World Affairs Council presentation produced in collaboration with 360 North. It was recorded on April 10, 2013 at Studio 360 in Juneau.
We're hearing the call of a hungry young gull, tagging along as its parent scavenges the beach for tidbits. Now, here's a fledgling great horned owl, perched in a tree, begging its parent to fly in with dinner. And here's another juvenile. A young hairy woodpecker, hitching along behind its parent on a mossy branch. By this time of year, these young birds are full-sized. They've left the nest and can fly short distances, but they still follow their parents and beg for food. Not only do they squawk and quiver, they also assume a begging posture, head hunched down with wings drooping. Some baby birds, like ducklings, goslings, and quail, feed themselves immediately after hatching. But most young birds depend on their parents for days, weeks, or even months after leaving the nest. In some species of jays, like these Mexican jays, the young birds stay with their family group through fall and winter and into the following breeding season. They're independent and able to feed themselves, but they help feed their parents' new brood. Stick around with us, and you can get BirdNote as a podcast. It all starts at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. K2 also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269.